You're listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KZYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both locations. You can call us in the studio a little later on in the program at 707-895-2448. Or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. My guest on this program is Erica Armstrong Dunbar. She's the Blue and Gold Distinguished Professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware. She's been the recipient of Ford, Mellon, and Social Science Research Council fellowships and is an Organization of American Historians Distinguished Lecturer. She's the author most recently of Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge, in which she chronicles the story of Martha Washington's chief attendant who fled to freedom and George Washington's determination to recapture his property by whatever means necessary. Professor Dunbar, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So this is a history set during the formation of our country in the late 18th and 19th centuries, and it tells some of the traditional stories centering around our first president and his wife, George and Martha Washington. The particular emphasis, however, is on slavery and the beginning of the abolitionist movement in the North, primarily, centering on the slaves owned by the president and his wife, and one in particular, a woman named Ona Judge. This emphasis is certainly not the one that I was taught when I went through school. Now, that's been a while, but I assume not the one still taught very much in today's schools. Would you please start us off by commenting on some of the challenges of doing this kind of history?
Sure. There's been such a wonderful response to the book, and many people have said exactly what you've just said, which is that they never knew her name, Ona Judge's name, or that they hadn't really thought about the history of the founding of the nation in this way. And that was my intent, to write a book that looked at the early years of the founding of the nation through the eyes of the enslaved. And typically what we get is a very kind of top-down story, perhaps through the eyes of founding fathers or people who knew them. And I wanted to do something different. I wanted us to be able to focus on what those initial years of this new nation looked like through not the people who were counted as fully human or counted as more than three-fifths of a person. I wanted to do it through the eyes of the enslaved. And Ona Judge, who was an enslaved woman, technically owned by Martha Washington, sort of served as a portal to get at some of these issues, these ideas. And she's sort of perfect in that she allows us to move through the founding, the new nation, in different kind of geographical spaces. So she moves from the South to the Mid-Atlantic to New England, and I'm able to sort of trace her life and the lives of others to sort of shine light on this moment. And so this kind of work is it's difficult at best when we historians are dependent upon archives. And for the most part, when we think about the late 18th and early 19th century, oftentimes the voices of women, of the enslaved, of people of color in general, aren't present in the same kinds of ways that we see them present from the pens of white literate men. And so it requires sort of extra patience, reading between lines, and lots of determination to be able to trace the lives of these people who are often not present in the archives in the ways that we're accustomed to. So, but I feel sort of privileged to be able to have the opportunity, the time, the space, the resources to do it.
And she's perfect in another way, in that she did grant some interviews at the end of her life, so you have that record.
Which is, I'm so very grateful that she made that decision at the end of her life to offer two interviews to abolitionist newspapers, one to the Granite Freeman and one to the most well-known abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, in 1847, giving us her voice, her thoughts about her her enslavement, more specifically about her escape, and her thoughts about slavery and the president in general. And for and with those interviews, I was able to begin really sort of peeling back the layers of Ona's life, who, as a fugitive for decades, it was difficult to find a great amount of sort of written evidence about her life, because for fugitives, anonymity is extremely important. And so it took extra time, as I said, and patience to find her.
Yeah, I'd like you to also talk, if you would, for just a minute about, I think, the value of doing some of this kind of history. I used to teach an intro to humanities class, and one of the exercises I had students do was to just call out the names of geniuses, and I'd write them up on the board. And every time I taught this class, I could just set it up exactly that way, and I'd start writing names, and I'd get a board full of names, and then I'd ask them, okay, so what's missing from that board? And every time, both women and blacks were missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, I feel, as I said, I feel really fortunate that my profession allows me to focus on those people, those names that we often don't know or aren't told or told about frequently. And when I think about more sort of current social media campaigns, like Say Her Name, which was, of course, connected to the lives of black women who have met either with violence or worse than that, as a way to sort of make certain that we don't forget people who I call sort of, you know, regular folk, regular people who in many ways wouldn't be noted in the archives or in history. And I think that there's a great amount of interest in these stories, and that's evident through the most recent blockbuster film, Hidden Figures. When we think about the lives of the women who were chronicled in Hidden Figures, you know, these are people, as you said, you know, we're not taught about them in our history classes in elementary school or even in high school. And so it's really left to, I think, scholars and hopefully now playwrights and screenwriters to do their very best to make certain that we do know some of these names, that they're not hidden. And I'm hopeful that with the publication of this book, that Ona Judge is no longer a hidden figure, that we can and will know her name in the ways that we know a Frederick Douglass or even a Harriet Tubman, that she did what these folks did, meaning she escaped from bondage decades before they did, decades before the construction of this kind of loosely connected underground railroad, and that she managed to do it while being considered the property of the most important family in the nation. And it's an incredible story.
Well, the way you get into the book, and we might as well start there, is by talking about her mother, and her mother was owned by that family. And so start getting in and fleshing out some of the story here, if you would.
Sure. So Ona Judge, let me make a sort of distinction here. Oftentimes, anyone who's heard of Ona Judge typically they've heard her referred to as Oney Judge, which was the name that the Washingtons called her, and I believe that that was the diminutive of her name, sort of like my little Oney. And I made the decision to call her what she went by at the end of her life, which was Ona, as a sort of marker of adult dignity. And so Ona was born at Mount Vernon sometime between 1773-74. We don't know her exact birth date because Washington did not record the dates, birth dates of the enslaved. However, we know that she was born the product of a relationship between an enslaved woman named Betty, who was considered the property of Martha Washington. Martha Washington was married once before George Washington. She was widowed. And she walked into this marriage with George Washington with a significant amount of property, wealth, that really centered upon the bodies of enslaved people. And when she married Washington, she came to Mount Vernon, and she brought with her an enslaved seamstress named Betty, who carried with her her son, her infant son, Austin. And at some point, we don't know when, but at some point she encountered a man named Andrew Judge, who was also living at Mount Vernon as a white indentured servant. And he was a tailor. She was a seamstress. I don't know the background to their relationship. What I do know is that at some point, Ona Judge was born, and she's the only person on the records at Mount Vernon with the surname of Judge, aside from Andrew Judge. And her description that the Washingtons offer do sort of confirm that she was of mixed race. And so she is born at Mount Vernon and really lives at Mount Vernon. At the age of 10, she's brought to work at the Mansion House and becomes basically what many call a house slave. She learns to be a seamstress as like her mother and spinner, and really learns the responsibilities of what we call a domestic slave, someone who had the most intimate of responsibilities in the house. And she sort of works her way up from the age of 10 to 16, sort of becoming Martha Washington's, for the lack of a better phrase, top slave. And she would have been responsible for helping Martha Washington bathe, helping her brush her hair, really sort of attending to whatever needs that Martha Washington had. And for this reason, Ona, along with six other enslaved people, are chosen to travel with the Washingtons when George Washington is elected president of the United States. And Ona is taken from Mount Vernon as a 16-year-old and brought to the north, to New York, for the beginning of a northern life.
So start to talk about that then, and any other background that you'd just like to add about this very, very big transitional time in our history where George Washington has just become president and he's taking those reins of power, that office, and she goes along with him to New York. And you talk about in the book just kind of the situation in New York in terms of its view of slavery at the time, and it's a transitional time for all of that there.
One of the things I wanted to do with the book was to dismantle a couple of myths. And one of those myths, of course, is about sort of free life in the North, this kind of myth that for black people that the North just meant freedom and that the South meant enslavement. And what we see through Ona's life is that she leaves Mount Vernon in 1789 and arrives in a new state, New York, a state in which slavery is heavily practiced, in which many of the major politicians of the time owned people of African descent. But there was a growing free population as well. And so we get to see a New York that's wrestling with eventually ending slavery, but is certainly not there yet. But it's really Ona's first experience with black freedom. And this is happening simultaneously with the founding of a nation, with the creation of a presidency, with George Washington, who travels to New York and is quite uncertain himself about the future of the nation, about his ability to lead the nation. He writes, you know, that he's concerned, he's uncertain, yet is called to duty and obligated, he felt, to serve his nation again. And travels to New York, and for all those fans of the smash hit Hamilton, we sort of see this moment where the nation's capital switches from New York eventually to Philadelphia fairly quickly. And so Ona and the enslaved men and women who travel with the Washingtons actually only live there for a brief period of time. By November 1790, the capital switches to Philadelphia. for the next 10 years. And Ona travels to Philadelphia, which is another sort of wake-up call, and it reminds us, it allowed me to show the kind of rich history and the difference between northern states. So Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, rather, is wildly different from New York. And when Ona arrives in Philadelphia, now one of nine enslaved men and women of the Washingtons, she witnesses or lives in a state where she is in the minority. She is an enslaved person when there are very few in Pennsylvania and many, many, many more free black people. And it's this experience that I argue in the book really kind of informs her. She lives in a state where she's in the minority and she sees black freedom kind of in full view in front of her. She sees black men and women as entrepreneurs, selling their fruits and oysters and pepper pot soup in the streets. She sees black churches like Mother Bethel being built around the corner from her home. And she witnesses all of this while in this peculiar position as an enslaved woman of the Washingtons. And this, I argue in the book, kind of informs her as she comes into her adult life. So really between the ages of 17 or so and 22, she lives in Philadelphia and experiences a cosmopolitan life that she would never have experienced in at Mount Vernon, and one that I think marks her and quite possibly marks George Washington, too, in terms of his opinion and feelings about enslavement. And it's here in Philadelphia. We often think about Philadelphia as the sort of birthplace of freedom in the nation, and it clearly becomes that for Ona Judge. It's here in this space that she learns about what black freedom is, what it can be, the problems connected to it as well, the difficulties, rather. And she weighs this against what her life was like in Virginia, what it was still like for her mother and siblings left behind, and it changed her.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is Professor Erica Armstrong Dunbar, author of Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. Well, I mean, talk about a coming-of-age story. I try to get into the mind of this young woman, and she's come out of the place in the South in Virginia where there's none of that kind of possibility and gets exposed to it in very short order in two different contexts in both New York and Philadelphia. And while we don't have any kind of record or diary from her, you can just begin to imagine what must have been going on in her mind.
Yeah, we don't have a diary from her because, you know, she was illiterate, as were most enslaved people. But fortunately, George Washington kept excellent records, as did the members of his staff in his household. And so what I've been able to do is to draw from his account ledgers and his own correspondence that do comment upon her life. So I know when money was given to Ona to purchase stockings or new shoes, or I know that she was given a ticket to go to a specific play or to go to see the tumblers at the circus. And so this is what historians must do, especially those who work in early African American women's history. You know, we have to read in these very kind of slim spaces and pull out that kind of information in order to draw a bigger picture, to paint a bigger picture of what life was like for the enslaved or for free black people at this moment. And so fortunately, I do have the records from others, not from Ona, about this moment in her life, about these years. And also, you know, my first book, which was about how black women became free in the North, it really, you know, an academic book that came out in 2008, helped me helped me write and fill in some spaces in Never Caught. And I think that's what scholars, you know, that we have to do, that we draw upon our scholarship, our past scholarship, to inform our newer works. And so in some spaces where I may not have had Ona's words or thoughts, I definitely have the words and thoughts of other Black women living in the same moment, in the same kinds of conditions. And so I've been able to draw upon that source as well. But yeah, fortunately, we do have the slimmest of documents and material about her.
So why don't you just flesh out just a little bit more about the abolitionist movement. You talk about both Black activists and the Quakers as being very much involved in that.
Yeah, I think when we're talking about the 1790s, and this is the moment where Washington is living in the North and Ona is as well, it really sort of predates what we would call a strong abolitionist movement, but there are clearly abolitionist groups that are forming and that are, for multiple reasons, have concerns and issues with human bondage, with enslavement. And it just so happens that when Ona arrives in Pennsylvania, that the state had already, the Commonwealth had made decisions about the future of slavery, and that it would eventually end. So prior to Ona's arrival, the gradual emancipation law was passed in 1780 in Pennsylvania, and it really kind of limited slavery. It was written with the understanding that eventually it would end. So March 1st, 1780, if you were born as an enslaved person on that day or thereafter, you could only be held in bondage for up to 28 years. I probably shouldn't use the word only, but because in the 18th century, that was the majority of your life. But it was a difference from lifelong enslavement. And so clearly, slavery was on its way out. It was on its deathbed by the late 1790s when Ona is living in Philadelphia. She's one of maybe 100 enslaved people in Philadelphia. And so she arrives in a place that has already, that is really led in many ways by Quaker men and women who for many, many years had protested against African bondage. And so we see that all coming into view in a state where the president is living with enslaved people. And it's a collision course that George Washington and Martha Washington have to really encounter and navigate carefully, because the law was not on their side in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it really starts to get into the lengths that they went to maintain that status of their enslaved people. And I found that very interesting because of the law, and you can get into it here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, the law, as I said, it wasn't on George and Martha Washington's side. And basically the law stated that if you were a non-resident, if you came to Pennsylvania as a non-resident and you brought your enslaved men and women with you, that you could only remain in the state for up to a limited period of time, 6 months. And after 6 months, if you did not leave, your enslaved people could be set free, that they were entitled to emancipation. And when George and Martha Washington catch wind of this, the attorney general pays them a visit, says, look, you're looking for trouble. Some of my slaves have run off because of this. And I just want you to sort of be aware. George Washington, in his correspondence between himself and his secretary, Tobias Lear, he makes it very clear that they were to create basically a plan of slave rotation, where they would purposefully rotate their slaves out of the state every 6 months, either back to Mount Vernon in Virginia or perhaps across the river to Trenton, New Jersey, and basically restart the clock on enslavement. And he says in his letters that he doesn't want this to be known to the enslaved people who worked for him, who lived with him, or to the public. And so this is a moment where we know George Washington is not necessarily breaking the law, but he's clearly breaking the spirit of the law in order to maintain his enslaved men and women, the status of their enslavement in Pennsylvania. And it's a moment where, you know, we think about the authority of the presidency, we think about issues of enslavement, and the kind of inherent contradictions that were very, very clear at this moment when liberty and democracy, you know, this was the language of the era of the revolution, and clearly in this moment where the nation is founded, yet we see a stark contrast when we're thinking about a fifth of the rest of the population, the majority of whom are enslaved.
You talk a little bit in the book about Martha's role in all this, too. And as you mentioned, Ona was actually owned by Martha. Could you fill that out just a little bit to give us a sense of the relationship there and her relationship with the president?
Yeah. You know, I think one thing that's important to note is that all of the correspondence, the majority of it, between Martha Washington and George Washington no longer exists. Martha burned the majority of their letters. I think there are four or so letters that managed to escape the fire that were in other places. But we don't have a lot from Martha's own hand about Ona Judge, about this, about the enslaved who lived in Philadelphia. But we do know that, you know, she comes to the marriage with George Washington with a sort of different sensibility about slave ownership. And she leaves this earth, she dies with the same kinds of sensibilities. And what's so wonderful is that we can compare George Washington to a Martha Washington through this book, Never Caught, that while George Washington is really changing, we see his opinions about slavery change over time. We don't see that in the same way with a Martha Washington. And where George Washington is beginning to question and feel at the very least uncomfortable or uncertain about human bondage, and he writes this, you know, and he talks about, quote, getting quit of his Negroes. That's what he writes, that he's trying to sort of figure this out towards the end of his life. How do I let go of a tremendous amount of wealth through human bondage? How do I do this? And he never figures it out, right? He doesn't, at least not while he was living. He makes the decision to hold on to slaves, and he does not emancipate any enslaved people until his will. And in his will, he states that the enslaved people, over 100, who were living at Mount Vernon, were to be emancipated upon the death of Martha. And that, so even in death, he wanted to make certain that the value, the luxury, the wealth that was attached to these human bodies, it was still transferred to his wife until she departed this earth. Now, Martha Washington understood she was the larger slave owner, and she actually had the majority of the wealth, and she actually made the decision to emancipate George Washington's slaves after or before she died. She understood the only thing standing in between their freedom was her life. And so she sort of, I think, in a smart move, made the decision to emancipate them early, but never emancipated any enslaved people that were a part of her estate passed down from her first husband. And so, you know, there's some discussion that, well, you know, she didn't necessarily have the ability to emancipate enslaved men and women who were a part of an estate. Well, you know, she figured out a way to do that with George Washington's will, to alter the will. And she did actually own one enslaved person, at least outright, that was not transferred through through a will, and she never emancipated this person either. And so we get to see a kind of study in contrast that Martha Washington was someone who was committed to the institution of slavery and to passing down the wealth that came with it to her grandchildren. George Washington had no biological children, and I think that's something we often forget, that while Martha Washington did have children with her first husband, she had none with George. And he did not have the expectation of inheritance from children. He had heirs. He had nephews and cousins and what have you. But I think in many ways that allowed Washington a road to eventually emancipate his enslaved people because he had no children who were expecting them.
Right. Well, let's get back to Ona Judge. You start talking about trying to get into her head a little bit about the kinds of thinking she might have had that spurred her choice or decision eventually to run away.
Yeah. She, aside from living in the North and witnessing Black freedom, which I think was the biggest sort of intervention in her life or marker of difference for her, there was a moment in 1796 where she realizes that her life is about to change. And in February of 1796, she catches wind, or the Washingtons find out, that Martha Washington's granddaughter, Eliza Park Custis, has made a decision to get married. And she's going to kind of run off with this guy that people don't know so well. And Martha Washington's very nervous about it and upset. And while she signs off on the marriage, she makes a decision to help her granddaughter. And she makes a decision to give Ona Judge, her best slave, to her granddaughter as a wedding gift and as someone who would be willed to her eventually upon Martha Washington's death. And it's this change in ownership that sort of pulls the trigger on Ona's decision to eventually escape the Washingtons. And she's very careful in her interview. She never gives us the names of the men and women, the free Black men and women who help her escape. She's very clear that it is the free Black community that helps. She does give us one name of a ship captain by the name of John Bowles, who was a white man who lived in New Hampshire, who had a shipping business. She tells us that he is actually the person who ferried her eventually out of Philadelphia to what she calls freedom. And it's this change in ownership. It's the witnessing of Black freedom around her that prompts Ona to, on May 21st, 1796, while the Washingtons were eating their supper, she leaves the president's house, never to return. And this begins her life now not as the most, perhaps most respected or, I would argue respected enslaved person of who worked for Martha Washington, but now as a fugitive. And it begins a new segment of her life, one that would span nearly half a century.
Well, there's another instigator there, too. George Washington wasn't going to run for a third term, so they were going to be leaving Philadelphia, and the opportunity to get away would have been quite different in Philadelphia than back in Virginia.
Exactly. Knowing that, and at this point, Washington made the decision not to run for a third term. The public didn't know it. The family did. And so in the relatively small president's house in Philadelphia, the enslaved there knew that their time was limited in the North. And there's actually, we know later on, that it doesn't only affect Ona Judge, but that the others are thinking about what that means, how their lives will change once they return to Mount Vernon. We know that one enslaved person by the name of Hercules, who was the sort of famed chef of the Washingtons, he actually knows that this is, going to upset the possibilities of escape. And while he's unable to escape in Philadelphia, he eventually does escape the Washingtons from Virginia. But it clearly is a moment that all who were held in human bondage had to reconcile with it. Okay, perhaps you're returning to Virginia and to see your family and friends, but this would end life as they knew it in the North. And Ona says in her interviews that she knew that there was no way she was going to be the slave of that woman, meaning Eliza Park Custis, and that she knew that if she didn't take the opportunity to leave. When she did, she wrote, or rather stated in her interview, that she knew she would never have the chance at liberty. And so she used her location in Philadelphia, the knowledge about her change in ownership, and also the presence of a free black community to make that final decision to run off.
There's a lot in the book about that time after she escapes, and maybe that'll come out here. I want to open the phone lines for listeners to give us a call. And if you're just joining us, the phone number, by the way, is 895-2448. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is Professor Erica Armstrong Dunbar, historian and author of Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. If you'd like to ask some questions about this part of our nation's history and about this particular story, please give us a call, 895-2448. We'll take your calls as soon as we can. So she escapes, and you already mentioned that she gets on this boat. Why don't you flesh that out just a bit?
So we know that in her interviews she states that she takes her belongings to a group of free black associates, and she doesn't name them, of course. And they arrange for her passage on a ship called the Nancy. And one of the things I was able to do was to track this Captain John Bowles, who is in Philadelphia in May of 1796 with his ship, the Nancy, that leaves port around the time that Ona runs off. And eventually makes its way to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I remember at first realizing that, you know, she's in New Hampshire, and I thought, that's a kind of interesting location. Like, why New Hampshire? At first I thought, why not New York or perhaps, you know, Boston? And then, of course, you know, it's clear that she can't return to New York. She's a sort of known entity. People know her face. She'd lived there and was, you know, Martha Washington's top slave. That would have been a very risky decision, although many fugitives found their way to New York. It wasn't a good place for Ona. And she says, actually, she doesn't know where she's going. She's thinking it's either Boston or some other location, and it ends up being Portsmouth, which clearly her free associates felt was a relatively safe place for her to land, and that it would be a place that maybe she could hold on to anonymity for a lengthy period and to hide, to stay away from the Washington. Well, I think that, you know, what's so amazing about Ona's story is that here she is, 22 years of age, making the decision to literally steal herself, her body, from the Washingtons, from the most important or powerful family in the nation. And as a 22-year-old enslaved woman, she does this. She runs and she finds the courage, the strength, the wit to find allies, to arrive in Portsmouth, and to really begin her life anew as a fugitive. And sets about the work that any of the other men and women who did the same thing, and I think one thing to remember is that Ona's clearly not the first person to run away from slavery. She's not, and she wouldn't be the last, and that the work of escape was one thing, but the work of creating and building a life as a fugitive was another. And the fact that she's able to do this while being hunted is almost unbelievable.
She's not the first and last, but she was one of the few women. Most who ran away would have been men.
Yes, I think one of the things historians have uncovered in terms of the numbers is that most fugitives, most who were able to escape and remain detached from their owners, were young men, and typically young men who were relatively healthy and able to do so. And when we think about young women, young enslaved women, who were typically at the peak of their sort of reproductive years, more often than not, they had children. and to run off to become a fugitive with a baby or a small child in tow, it was done, but it was extremely difficult. And for this reason, we often find that fugitives were men, and that women stayed behind with their children, or in the life of Harriet Jacobs, a well-known fugitive in the 19th century. She actually lived in her grandmother's attic. She ran to her grandmother's attic and lived there for years, watching her children grow, rather than being able to escape to the north. Eventually, she does. But Ona's story is different because she is a young woman, having been a enslaved woman as a domestic, a house slave. She did not have children, at least not while working with the Washingtons, or at least none that I have been able to trace. And for that reason, I think it gave her a little more flexibility to make her way to New Hampshire and to begin her life.
So you've talked a little bit about the kind of background of New York and Philadelphia. What were things like in Portsmouth and New Hampshire at the time?
I think it's important to note that in Portsmouth, when Ona arrives, I think the most startling difference between, say, a Philadelphia or even a New York is the small number of black people, period. So when she arrives in Portsmouth, you know, there are more black people at Mount Vernon than there are in the entire city of Portsmouth. And so in some ways that makes hiding even more difficult. But what she's able to do is to connect with a small, free black population in Portsmouth. She is protected. I know your listeners are I don't want to tell all of this story. I want
right.
them to be able to go off and to read the book. So I'll be careful with my words, because I do think that the latter part of her story, the pursuit by George and Martha Washington, is a really sort of important one. But I think what the book tells us is that Ona lives a life as a free person, although she is not free. She is, and that's the reason that the title is of the book is what it is. It's never caught. I didn't want to use the term free or freedom, because the reality was that she wasn't free. She was simply never caught. She remained detached from the Washingtons. And I think that, for readers, is one of the most incredible things about Ona's story, that here are the Washingtons, some of the most powerful people in the nation, who are unable to reclaim an enslaved person. And part of it is her determination, her grit, her sort of self-confidence in some ways, and a community of both free blacks and of white men and women who are rethinking slavery in a place like New Hampshire, who are unwilling to assist the president in perhaps the ways that he expected.
Okay, I do want to invite people who are listening to this program about, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This. My guest is historian Professor Eric Armstrong Dunbar. Her book is Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. If you'd like to give us a call and ask a question of Professor Dunbar, the phone number is 895-2448. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Kate.
Hey, Kate, go ahead.
So, I love this book. I'm going to buy it right away. The reality of history is so different than what we were fed. I'm born in the 50s, especially born in the 50s. Have you ever thought of making a screenplay, of writing a screenplay? Because this is an incredible story. I could just see it before my eyes, you know? I think it would be a phenomenal movie, and because so few people read. Unfortunately, best way to get to people in terms of what really is historically true is unfortunately through that medium.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Thank you for those comments. I agree with you that I'm a historian. You know, I've written more academic books. I wanted this to be a book that was a general audience read, because I agree with you that history should be accessible. whether you are someone who is a reader or not. And I do think that film is a space that allows for these stories to be shared on a wider level, film and television. I also think that we're in a moment right now where we are seeing more in the way of the stories of the enslaved. And so when we think about films like 12 Years a Slave or the sort of reboot of Roots that came out last May.
And even just recently, Moonlight, which I know it's, you know, contemporary, however,
right.
Everything that is written and everything that's performed seems to bear witness to the past.
Yes, and I think, I agree with you that film is another vehicle to make certain that these stories become a more known part of our narrative of American history. And so my response will be, because I often get the film question, you know, the one thing people say is this story is, as they're reading the book, that it's almost cinematic.
I'm not a screenwriter.
But I will say that there is interest in making in taking this book and having it perhaps become something else. And so I'm not a screenwriter. I won't undertake it. What I will do is you know, if this book becomes a film or some kind of television production, it's my intent to make sure that the academic integrity is
the historical fact. Yes,
exactly, and that's what's important.
Thanks
and
for the call.
I have one more comment.
Oh, okay, quickly.
Just the white privilege element. I am so glad to see historians like yourself do a factual piece of history because it challenges white privilege. Thank you.
I think that I wanted very much, as I said in the beginning, to perhaps, you know, the challenge is there by the premise of the book, which is to tell the story of the beginning of the founding of the nation through the eyes of the enslaved. And so it changes the voice and it changes who is centered in the story. And I hope that that helps to dismantle some things that that we need to continue to work on. So thank you, though, for your comment.
Let's take another call. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Hi, yes, this is Frida.
Hi, Frida, go ahead.
Thank you so much for the show. And I'm my ears were picked up and focused on the issue of John Bowles, and I wanted to say that my childhood friend was named John Bowles. He was African American, and he would have been born in the early 1950s, 52 to 54, and I'm just curious if you have information on more of around John Bowles' lineage and if he did father mixed race children. What you if you know of anything about more about his, I know you know more, but if you can share more about what you know.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, when I think it's important because he's actually the only person that Ona names in an interview in terms of a person who helped her escape. And she does that because he's deceased, so therefore he can't be held, you know, accountable for breaking federal law, which was helping a fugitive escape. And so when I found his name at first or read his name for the first time, I thought, okay, he must have been an abolitionist. He must, you know. And, you know, I was expecting to find that, and I couldn't find him sort of attached to any sort of early abolitionist movement. I think what we do know about John Bowles is that he was, like many others, he had a shipping company and went back and forth between Portsmouth and Philadelphia and New York sometimes. He sold candles and saddles, and he brought molasses and other coffee back and forth. And one of the things that ship captains often did was they allowed passengers to ride along to sort of make a little extra money. And what's clear is that Bowles allows Ona to do this. And so we don't know if it's a sort of, if he does this because he simply wants the money, or if he's just willing, clearly he's willing to turn turn a blind eye to a very unusual passenger, right, to who is leaving Philadelphia and heading for Portsmouth. But one of the interesting things is I was in a doing a book reading a couple of weeks ago in New Hampshire, and a descendant of John Bowles was there. And she approached me and she said, you know, I can't remember, I think it was like her great-great-great-grandfather was John Bowles, and she never knew the history of him in this kind of detailed way. I don't have a record of John Bowles being in having mixed race children, but I'm certain, you know, the name, there were other Bowles in New Hampshire, in Portsmouth, and I don't know if the person you're talking about is a direct descendant, but he's someone who's fairly well known, at least now, through Never Caught in other ways, up in New Hampshire. But he's an incredible he's an incredible character in this history about whom we don't know much, but I would encourage other people to follow up on his story.
Thanks for the call.
Well, thank you so much for that information.
Trying to get no more calls here. So we're getting down to the end of the time here, Professor Dunbar. So maybe if you'd like to give us any final thoughts. Once again, if you're just joining us, you've been listening to Consider This. My guest has been historian Professor Erica Armstrong Dunbar. Her book is Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge.
Yeah, I think I'm trying not to. I don't want to give everything away. I want to leave people with the opportunity to read the book and to follow Ona's life. What I will say is that there's sort of three, I think, major moments in this book. One, of course, her life as an enslaved person. One, the second moment being her escape. And the third moment being living as a fugitive. And so she lives until the age of 22, she escapes. But for 50 years, she lives as a fugitive. So for nearly half a century, she spends her life looking over her shoulder and realizing that even the family that she puts together for herself, you know, that they're vulnerable to slave catchers because slavery followed the apron strings of its women. And it did not matter that she had run to the North. She was a fugitive according to the laws that George Washington himself had signed into motion in 1793. People who owned slaves could cross state lines and get their slaves back. And she knew this. And she knew that any children she had would also be vulnerable to being taken to a place they never knew in Virginia. And I think what we're able to see through Ona's remaining years, of which there were many, is what it meant to be a black person at this moment in time, whether you were enslaved or free. What does freedom mean in a nation that still practices slavery? How free is free if you have to carry papers to identify yourself, or if you're threatened with the idea of being kidnapped, like we saw with Solomon Northrup's narrative, 12 Years a Slave, which was much later, but still a possibility then of being taken into slavery, even though you were a free person. And I think this story helps us get at some of the inherent contradictions around freedom and democracy. And these are issues that have really, we've grappled with as a nation from its founding moments, and we could argue up to the present.
Once again, the book is Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. Professor Dunbar, thanks very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.